And as the kids are going, I want to call us back to our attention to the book of Exodus, where we're going to be hanging out these last few Sundays before Thanksgiving. We are almost done with the book of Exodus. It's been a great journey through this book so far. And we're picking up today in the sequence here right after last week, where the nation is in pieces. The nation is in shambles because of their failure last week as they wandered into idolatry. Many of you were here last week. Many of you were not here. It was almost like a ghost town. Like, where did everybody go? There was a retreat, and the people were sick, and Messiah was on a fall break. But if you didn't, if you weren't here last week, you can listen to it online, or you can just read chapter 32, the golden calf. And this would be what people today would call an epic fail, right? Kids use that term today. The Urban Dictionary, you can look it up online, says an epic fail is a failure of such monumental proportions that it needs its own term. So that's what we call it, an epic fail. If you don't know what an epic fail is, there's all kinds of pictures you can find that are illustrations of it. So I've got a couple of those just to kind of help us get to it. This is an epic fail because he's washing his car in pouring down rain. There's no need to be washing your car. So that's an epic fail. And then you've got this one here. It's a Clean Air Express bus that's on fire. And it is polluting the air greatly. Yeah, so that is an epic fail. We got another one here of poor engineering. That is an epic fail of monumental proportions. And needless to say, that guy probably lost his job. The Israelites' failure was exchanging God for a cheap substitute. What we talked about last week. That after even just 40 days of Moses being away, their hearts changed like that, and they worshiped this golden calf. After God had been walking with them so clearly and so faithfully up until this time, in just 40 days, they turn and they're in the middle of sin, and they epically failed. Now, that becomes the backdrop for these next several passages that will finish us out as we head toward Thanksgiving, just a couple more weeks in the book of Exodus. This failure that they had as a nation, and then how God responds. And last week we saw how God did respond with judgment on the nation. Some harsh judgment in order to wake them up, in order to help them to realize what they had done. And you can read through that. But God didn't just stop there. In chapter 33, the beginning of the chapter is even a more pronounced consequence than even what had been done earlier. And I'll just summarize what that is at the beginning of chapter 33. God, in essence, says to the people that, you know, it's time for you guys to get up and to get going and to head toward the promised land. You need to start heading there. And here's what is going to happen. I'm going to send an angel ahead with you. And he had already promised that before. But he said, I'm going to send an angel up ahead with you. But I myself and now no longer going to go with you. I cannot go with you. Because if I did, I think I would consume you. I would wipe you out. Because you've proven your sinfulness here. And you are a stiff-necked people. There's a term of endearment from God. If you ever want to have an insult from God, just be have him call you a stiff-necked person. Unwilling to yield. Unwilling to bow before him and follow him. But it was right. They deserved this. They proved that they would turn on God at the drop of a hat. And so he says, I'm not going to go with you in my visible, accessible presence. Now, let me just tease that out for a second here. In some sense, you could go, well, of course God's going to be with him because God's everywhere, isn't he? The omnipresence of God means he's everywhere present, all at the same time. There's nowhere you can go to get away from God's presence. In the whole entire universe, God is everywhere. But God makes his manifest presence known only in specific places. That's where we can see him. We can experience him. We know where he shows up. And that's one of the things, the concepts that was talked about at the beginning of worship today, that God's manifest presence would be made known to us as we seek him and we want to meet with him. That first song was that prayer, Lord, come and meet with me. And that's the same idea of what's going on here. God's saying, of course, my omnipresence is everywhere, but my manifest presence is no longer going to go with you. And I'm not sure what all that meant because God didn't define it all, but think about how God had been going with them so far. He'd been with them in a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. He had been with them in some pretty tangible ways and done some incredible miracles as they'd gone along. But also think about what God had just told Moses on the mountain for 40 days. Back on Labor Day weekend, we outlined chapters and chapters and chapters of instructions that God gave them to build something specific. Do you remember what that was? To build the tabernacle. The tabernacle was a portable temple, a portable system of tents and poles, a really elaborate system of those things, but that they would take with them and they would set it up when they were camping, and they would just kind of have this life of operating around the temple or the tabernacle. Then when it was time to leave, they would pack it all up and they would move and it would go to the next place. And then they would have God's presence with them there. And then they would pack it up and go to the next place. The tabernacle was how God was going to be with them in a very visible and tangible way. The tabernacle consisted of an outer courtyard that everyone was allowed to come into. That's where the sacrifices were made. That's where you would bring your sacrifices, where you would pray. Then there was a more restricted tent that was it was called the holy place, where only the priests could go in, and there were certain things that they would do in there with the bread of the presence and lighting of candles and these different things. Certain priests were allowed in there. And then there was the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was. It was this box overlaid with gold and these cherubim with these big wings spread out over top of the ark. That was a place that only one priest could go once a year on the Day of Atonement and come into that place. And the presence of God would glow and shine there above the Ark of the Covenant. And if God is saying, I'm going to send an angel up ahead of you, but I myself am not going to go with you, then one big implication of that was, don't bother building the tabernacle, because I'm not even going to be there. I'm not going to go with you guys as a nation. This was devastating news to Moses and to the nation. And we're going to cover that in those first couple of verses of chapter 33. We're going to cover that next week. We're going to save that because it goes thematically with the next part of the chapter from verse 12 on. But we're going to read today and focus in on verses 7 through 11. And if you have your Bibles open to Exodus 33, we're going to start there at verse 7. Now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. And whenever Moses went to the tent, all the people rose and stood at the entrances to their tents and watching Moses until he entered the tent. As if Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they all stood and worshipped, each at the entrance to his own tent. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. By the way, Joshua was the first one with no parents. He's obviously the son of Nun. Or you could talk about, like a Catholic nun, that would be kind of weird because they don't have children because they don't get married. So we're going to cover just these few verses this week, and it's all about this tent of meeting. And this tent of meeting was the place that it was a smaller tent than the tabernacle. Obviously, the tabernacle was huge. So this was just a small tent that Moses would put up outside of the camp as a place that he would go trekking out through the desert, out to this tent, and meet with God. And it said some pretty neat things would happen as Moses went out. Even after God had said, I'm not going to go with you, Moses had a special privilege. Anybody could go out to this tent and pray, but when Moses went, what happened? The pillar of cloud came down at the entrance of that tent, And the people were so amazed by that, of how Moses was able to talk to God so closely. The people would come out at the edge of their tents and see this thing happening out in the desert and be like, wow, God is still at least here in that sense with Moses. And they would stand at the entrance of their tent and worship God. It was an awesome thing that Moses had this ability to meet with God like that. And it says that Moses would talk to God face to face. Now, that can't be literal, because we're told in a scripture not too far from here that no one can see God and live. And so Moses was not going to be able to see God face to face literally. It's metaphorically speaking along the lines of how you would talk to a friend or how you talk to a neighbor. Moses had that kind of close relationship with God where they would speak to one another. It was an amazing relationship of how they could talk. And Moses had a regular habit of doing that, going out to this tent. Now, we need to have some perspective on this, because the very fact that God would still meet with Moses this way and still have access even for the people to go out and pray was a very gracious thing of God. Considering what he had just said earlier in the first part of chapter 33, when he said, I'm not going with you, for them to still have access to God like this at the tent of meeting was an awesome thing. However, it fell far short of the tabernacle. Let me point out a couple of ways of why it was lesser. It was still gracious of God, but it was less. See, the tabernacle was going to be built in the middle of the camp. So it was the centerpiece of it all. That was the design, and that all the people would literally encamp around the tabernacle. It was the middle. It was the central point of all their life, God's presence at the tabernacle. Well, that wasn't happening, and so this tent was outside the camp. Do you see that by the physical representation of where God was, it was far inferior of what was supposed to happen? All right? The tent of meeting was way out there. It was not in the middle. The other thing that was far inferior to it was the tabernacle's design was so that the whole nation could get involved. Now, only the priests would have special privilege to be inside of the holy place, and then the one priest to go into the Holy of Holies once a year. But everyone else could come at least into the outer courts and offer their sacrifices and pray and be right near the presence of God. That's what the design was for the tabernacle. But the tent of meeting outside of the camp, people could go and pray there, but it wasn't like the community life of the nation would go out to and pray together. That didn't happen. And really, the only one with a special privilege was one guy. It was Moses. It was very limited in who got to really experience God and experience his manifest presence. So this was not a great, long-lasting substitute that they wanted to just have this tent of meeting. But at least they had that. So why does this matter to us? Why should we care about whether Moses had this tent out in the desert and whether it was the tent of meeting or the tabernacle? Here's why. Because in either case, for us as believers, we have it better than the tent of meeting and we have it better than the tabernacle. Think about this tent of meeting and the access that people had. How many of you grew up in the day where either in college or in the military or some other place that you were away from home, there was only one telephone for a hall or a floor or for an entire dorm? I see one hand. Okay, come on, get those hands up. Some of you guys remember what that was like in the day. When I went to college, they actually had phones in every room. Woo! That was a big improvement. But back in the day, there was only one telephone per area. And so people would at night line up. I'm only told the legends of this. I never experienced it myself. People would line up waiting for their turn to talk on the phone. Because, you know, Billy and Johnny and David and all these guys, they all wanted to call home and talk to mom. And so Johnny's on the phone, he's talking to mom, and he only gets 5 minutes because everyone else is in line over here. And he's talking, and as he's finishing up, mom says, "Now, Johnny, I love you." And he has to say real quietly so no one can make fun of him, right? "I love you too, Mom. Okay, bye." And, you know, everyone could hear the conversation, and it was the outside world was only accessed from one point. Now, think about the world we live in, where we have these little guys, that you can talk on the phone anytime, anywhere you want to, in the middle of a cornfield. Everybody at college has one of these and can talk wherever they want, even to the point of nuisance in the middle of class. And people in how many of you guys in church have your cell phone with you right now? Have you turned it off, right? Because sometimes the ringer goes off in the middle of church. It's an amazing convenience that we have one of these to go anytime, any place. Driving in the car, walking around. That is the difference between Old Testament access to God's manifest presence and New Testament access to God's manifest presence. You don't have to go to one place where it's limited to either just the tent of meeting or even just the tabernacle where it's one place. We are given the manifest presence of God through the Holy Spirit living inside of us as believers. There's so much to unpack in that. We can't go through it all today. But just understand the huge theological difference that happened when God quit dwelling in a tent and began to dwell in these tents. These portable temples that can walk anywhere and carry the presence of God wherever we go. It's an amazing privilege that we have as believers. Another thing that's different about the day and age we live in is that Moses was the only one at that time who had the ability to talk to God on this friend-to-friend level. He was the only one that had the access in the tent of meeting to having God come and meet with him. And then even in the tabernacle, when that was built, there was only one tribe that had more access than all the other 11 tribes. And everyone else, the people, were scared to death to meet with God. They didn't have a friend-to-friend level. In God's omnipresence, they could talk to him anywhere. But they had no format to interact with his manifest presence. You remember the stories we've talked about how there was thunder and lightning and there was, you know, this voice that scared them half to death. And they said, Moses, you talk to God because if we talk to him, we're going to die. They were scared to death to talk to God. Moses was the only one who had this kind of relationship. But do you know, in the New Testament day and age, anybody, any believer can develop that kind of close relationship with God where you can talk to him as a friend would talk to a friend. We're able to develop that kind of relationship because the very presence of God that would have scared people half to death is now living inside of us. We're covered with the blood of Jesus. We're not going to be consumed and destroyed because of our sin. He wants to dwell in us. So we have this kind of access to God anywhere we want, at any time. This is an amazing time that we live in, folks, in biblical history. Now keep these thoughts in mind, and we're going to build on them a little bit, and we're going to take a couple of observations. As I was looking through these verses, I wanted to take some pieces of what you see in Moses and go, okay, well, if that's the access he had, what do we have? And these are going to be duh kind of observations. You're gonna hear me make these observations and go, well, yeah, of course, duh. You know, sometimes those are the best observations. All right, so the first one is this. Moses had a regular habit of meeting with God. Duh. It's in the verses. It's part of the language that's used in here. Verse 7, if you look down at your text, it says, now Moses used to take a tent. It's implying ongoing, regular access that he had to God. Verse 8, and whenever Moses went out to the tent, verse 11, the Lord would speak to Moses face to face. This wasn't a one-time event. It was a pattern for him. It was a discipline. He went regularly to go out and meet with God. Unfortunately, it is less and less common to find Christians who have a regular habit of meeting with God. Even with all of the amazing privilege that we have of cell phone access to God, we as Christians pass up our opportunity to meet with God like this. And there's some excuses. I was trying to think of, if you were Moses in that day and you had the schedule that he did, you had the life that he did, what kind of excuses would you come up with to not go and meet with God. Because we make the same excuses today. First observation, Moses was a pretty busy guy. Moses had a lot going on. If you think about it, he was the leader of a nation of 2 million people. He was the president. He was the priest, the pastor, the policeman, the judge, all these things rolled up into one. And if anybody had demands on him, it was Moses. If anybody had a lot of important things to do and from sunup to sundown was busy, the demands on his time, it was Moses. And yet, he made time regularly to go out and meet with God at the tent of meeting. Another thing that he could use as an excuse is he's a pretty gifted leader. I mean, goodness, look how far he's come from being raised as a prince of Egypt, which that was a pretty amazing thing to have the education that he had and everything. But he was pretty dejected when he left Egypt and he's spending 40 years out in the desert and he didn't think a whole lot of himself. But now he's had all this experience. He's had all this training. He's been the leader of Israel through some pretty amazing things and God had used him in some powerful ways and he has this track record of being this talented and gifted and powerful leader with authority. And Moses could have just coasted on that and been like, all right, I'm carrying out the orders God gave me. I'm doing my mission. I'm trying to stay on the right path here. People are following me. I made him drink ground up gold from an idol and drink it in water, and they're following me. But he did not coast on that. He had a regular habit of meeting with God. Another one he could have used is guilt. God's making me always come out and meet with him. He's calling me up a mountain and spending 40 days without food and water. He's always telling me to come get some more instructions. And frankly, I'm tired of that. And he's always on my case. And I just really don't want to meet with him right now. He's always asking me. It's like this burden, this law of having to go and meet with. It's like I have to go, not that I want to go. You could picture at some point Moses having a thought cross his mind like that. You ever have those thoughts cross your mind? These exact same ones? I'm too busy. I got too much going on. I think I'm doing all right. And I feel like I have to. There's this law. I just have to come. And so it's not like I really want to be coming to meet with God. So then we just don't. There was a period of time in my life where I really wrestled with these excuses in a way that just kind of snowballed. I mean, I still struggle with them, if I'm honest, because Satan wants nothing more than to block our time with God. He's always at work trying to make these excuses and more to keep us away from God. But when I was in my later years of college and my years of seminary, I really struggled prioritizing having time with God. And the reason was, you know, very practically, I was having responsibility at a level I had never had before. Later on in my junior and senior year of college, I was taking like 17 or 18 credits. I was on the soccer team. I was an RA. I was on a traveling choir, traveling with the choir with music. I had a girlfriend that became a fiance. It takes a lot of time and effort. And just had a lot going on. And it was really hard to spend time with God and prioritize it and carve out time. And then when I did, a lot of times I felt sleepy. I would find myself falling asleep in the middle of it. And it was just hard. It became more difficult. And then I went off into seminary, and I was a full-time seminary student, and I was working almost full-time at a church. And I was a new husband, married, trying to figure out life. And it was hard. Well, you think Moses had it hard? You think we have it hard? I look back at those years and I go, man, sometimes I'd rather rewind the clock in terms of responsibility. Life doesn't get easier. It gets harder. There's more demands. There's more responsibility. There's more reasons why not to spend time with God that we can come up with. But Moses had a regular habit of going out to his tent of meeting and spending time with God. He knew he had to spend face-to-face time with God to get his direction from God, to worship with God, to get recharged, to get his directions because a nation was depending on him. and he knew he needed to do it. Bill Hybels wrote a book called Too Busy Not to Pray. It's a great title for a book, isn't it? And then he has a study guide that goes with it. And this is what he says at the very beginning of the study guide. God and I used to be rather casually related to one another. We didn't get along, or we didn't get together to talk very much. But now, however, we get together a lot. Not talking on the run, but carrying on substantial soul-searching conversations every morning for a good chunk of time. I feel as if I've gotten to know God a lot better since I started praying. The greatest fulfillment in my prayer life has not been the list of miraculous answers to prayer, although that has been wonderful. The greatest thrill has been the qualitative difference in my relationship with God. And when I started to pray, I didn't know that was going to happen. Prayerless people cut themselves off from God's prevailing power, and the frequent result is the familiar feeling of being overwhelmed, overrun, beaten down, pushed around, and defeated. Surprising numbers of people are willing to settle for lives like that. Don't be one of them. Nobody has to live like that. Prayer is the key to unlocking God's prevailing prayer, a power in your life. You think Moses had discovered that? He wanted that life of power. He wanted to know God's voice. He wanted to know God's peace. And he submitted his day and his challenges to God, and he listened. And God guided him. Folks, when you get into praying like that, you realize, how in the world did I ever get along without this before? How did I try to do life on my own before? Now I can do it with God. So we got to quit thinking that we have to spend time with God as if we tell our kids, you have to eat your vegetables, you have to clean your room. God says, you have to spend time with me. Quit thinking about it like that. And think about it like this. I need to spend time with God. If I don't do it, I'm depleted. I'm beaten down. I'm overrun. I'm powerless. And God's saying, just come. Just come. I want to be with him like the deer pants for water, as the psalm says. If you've ever gone an afternoon without eating, or you know, you skipped breakfast and skipped lunch, if you ever fast, or you just do it by accident because you're too busy to eat, and all of a sudden you realize, I'm hungry. If I don't get something to eat, I'm cloudy in my mind. I'm not thinking right. I'm just weak. It's a spiritual metaphor for how we feel when we skip time with God. I don't eat because I have to. I eat because, well, first of all, I like it. But because I need to. That's how we need to start looking at our time with God. A second observation about Moses is he had a tent of meeting that he went to. He had a place that was special for him, a place that he trekked out purposely to get away from the camp, to go out across the desert and pray. I know what you're thinking. You're like, Steve, but earlier you said we have the cell phone kind of connection with God. We can talk to him anytime, any place, wherever we go. And it's true. You can, and I hope you do all throughout your day. But how many of us would have a real personal and unhurried, relaxed conversation with somebody while we're in the middle of a busy street? Or when the TV is on and the computer is on and we have distractions all around us, or if you're in the middle of work, it's fine to talk during those times, but it's not okay to have a real close, unhurried, undistracted conversation with somebody. When I'm at home and my cell phone rings and my kids are up, there's only a couple places I can go to talk to somebody. I can go in my, not just my bedroom, I have to go into our bathroom and sometimes my closet to shut the door to where it's finally quiet where I can talk to somebody. So if you ever call my house and you hear doors shutting, you know what's happening. Or I can go on my front porch if it's quiet outside, or I can go another place is in my garage, because typically that's pretty quiet too. That's where you go. You got to find a place where you can talk to somebody where it's quiet, where there's no distractions, no TV, and no interruptions of conversations of people who are going to just, you know, bump into you and overhear your conversation. You want to go somewhere private. In college, I had a professor named John Tell Murphy, and he was a good Southern guy, and he grew up praying. He told the class he would go to this rock in his backyard where he would go day after day and just get away out in nature. But at this rock was his particular place he met with God. Why there? I don't know. But that was his tent of meeting where he would pray. I've heard of somebody who at lunchtime would get away from work. He started work really early, but he had, I think, like 45 minutes for lunch. He would go out to his car, get away from the work desk, go out to his car, shut the door. It's quiet. He could read his Bible and he could pray. John Wesley, the leader of the Methodist movement, talked about his mom, Susanna Wesley, and she had 19 kids. Oh, 19 kids. And unfortunately, several of them died young, but she had like 10 youngsters running around her house. And do you know what Susanna Wesley would do to meet with God? In the middle of the afternoon, she would take her apron and sit at the kitchen table and pull her apron up over her head. And all the kids knew, do not be loud and do not distract mom during that time. That was her tent of meeting, with the apron pulled up over her head, and she would read scripture and she would pray. People find their tent of meeting and they meet with God there regularly. For my wife, you'll see her on the front in the front room with a large like chair and a half that we have there. And she has her coffee in her hand. I've never seen her read her Bible without coffee. It's just what she does. And she reads her Bible and she prays there in the morning. For me, I don't like coffee. I'm with you, Nathan. I won't drink it. Give me something cold to drink. I'm much, even if it's cold outside, I don't know. And I'll sit at the breakfast table with my bowl of cereal, and I'll spend my time with God there. Or I'll come to the office early before anyone else is here. I drop my kids off at school, and then know I have a quiet office just to be with God. Where's your tent of meeting? Actually, let me just ask you, some of you, where is your tent of meeting? Where do you like to meet with God? Just some responses. You gotta get louder. I can't hear you. Dining room table? Deck? Yes. Your room? The commute to work?
In the bedroom
before the children are awake. Before the children are awake, yes. Good. You'd find a tent of meeting, a quiet place where you can meet with God. It's a practice that every believer needs to have. We could talk a long time about what should you do during that time. What should you read? How long should you read? How long should you pray? I'm not going to get into all that today. We could do classes on that. We could talk a long time on it. But I do want to show you one quote from Dallas Willard, who wrote a book called Divine Conspiracy, of how God just wants to be with us. And this is what he said. Many people have found prayer impossible because they thought they should only pray for wonderful but remote needs that they actually had little or no interest in, or even knowledge of, because we're supposed to pray for these things. Prayer simply dies from efforts to pray about good things that honestly do not matter to us. The way to get to meaningful prayer for those good things is to start by praying for what we are truly interested in. The circle of our interest then will inevitably grow in the largeness of God's love. Pray about things that matter. Do you think Moses prayed about things that mattered to him? Yeah. People are complaining, Lord, what are we going to do? We need water, Lord. Can you help us? Lord, I'm exhausted today. I need you to fill me up. I need you to help me get through this. I need wisdom on this decision coming up. I pray for my wife and my kids. Pray for what matters to you. And start there. Go to your tent. Go to it often. The last observation is a curious one because we don't know much about it, but it raises my eyebrows at least. And it was in verse 11, it's the very end, it says this, "Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent." So far in Exodus, Joshua's name has been dropped a few times because he was along with Moses when they went up the mountain, and he got to be along with Moses on a lot of key stuff. He was Moses' aide. What's going to happen, though, soon in the life of the Israelite nation is that he's going to be chosen as one of the 12 spies to go scout out the promised land. And he's going to be only one of the two spies that comes back and says, we can take this land. God's giving it to us. Let's do this. But the other 10 did not have that faith. But he and Caleb, because of his faith, are the ones who get to outlive all the rest of their peers, and they get to go into the promised land, and whereas the rest of the nation has to die off a whole generation. But not only that, then Joshua is chosen as the leader who would take over for Moses, and Joshua got to lead them into the promised land and do some amazing things. The first battle as they got into the new land was to take over Jericho, and Joshua met with God and heard the battle strategy. I want you to march around the city of Jericho six times, once a day for 6 days. And then I want you to, on the seventh day, to march around seven times and blow your trumpets really loud. And most of us would be like, really? That's the battle plan strategy? Marching and blowing trumpets? But Joshua said, okay, Lord, we'll do it. And they did it. And the walls came crashing down and they had an incredible victory that day. Not because of how great they were as an army, but because of how great God was. And Joshua was the guy who got to lead like that. Where do you think his faith was born out of, to follow God like that? Where do you think he had the confidence when it was time to believe God as a spy in the land? Where do you think that he got the ability to answer the call as the next leader of God's chosen people? It's because of little windows like this that we get into Joshua's life. That's mentioned in verse 11, that he would not leave the tent. He kept praying. He had been invited along with Moses. He got to hang out with God, and Joshua couldn't get enough. Every so often you see guys in Scripture, that men and women, who couldn't get enough of God. Think about David, who is this guy who just continually hungered and thirsted after God out in the fields as a shepherd and then as a young king and being in the temple, and he would just stay there for hours and hours and pray. You look at these prophets that would hear from God at all hours of the night. They would spend long times in prayer. You think about Jesus himself, who took prayer retreats overnight and prayed all night long. Even though he was God in the flesh, he was talking to his Father and communing with his Father, showing us what the life of a disciple really is like, depending on God, the Father, like he did. There was an insatiable quest for being in the presence of God, for praying. There are some folks like that here at our church, and I'm so thankful for you, because you have a ministry among us that others don't. You have a clear sense of the direction of God and the call of God. You have a conviction inside of you to stand for faith when we need to. You get things done in the kingdom. We have a few of them here at church, and I'd love to see more. People who would be willing to find a Moses and say, hey, you're a praying person. Can I go and hang out with you? Can I learn how to pray by praying with you? Some of you who are young in this whole journey of prayer, find somebody who is a prayer warrior and hang out with them. Pray with them. And some of you who are these prayer warriors, maybe you wouldn't describe yourself as an incredible prayer warrior, exactly like Joshua, but if you have a regular habit and practice of it and you love to pray, have you ever thought about inviting somebody else in to pray with you? Prayer is not taught. Prayer is caught. You got to spend time with people that pray in order to pray more and to pray more passionately and pray more effectively. I'd love to see that happen more at our church. God would love to see that happen more at our church. I would love to grow in this myself. Folks, being people who spend time with God is a privilege that I hope we discover more and more. He has an invitation to us to come and be with them. He never turns us away. God doesn't say, you stay out. You can't come. His grace shed for us on the cross, what we're going to celebrate here in just a few moments, is what qualifies us to come, not us. We're not that great. The fact that he loved us and paid for our sin is how we can come. And it's not legalism. It's not like we have to come and do this to make, to please God, and if we don't do this, he's mad at us. Folks, let's put it this way. If you want to avoid a mediocre and powerless life, then become a praying person. If you want to be ready to answer the call or to stand up for the fight that God has for you coming up here sometime, then be a praying person first. If you want to be able to discern His voice in your life and His will in your life, then be a praying person. It's an invitation. Don't miss out on being one of these kinds of people. We're going to end our service with a little bit of time to come to our tent of meeting with God. We're going to have communion. The very definition of that word is what Moses practiced with God. Communion. To talk like a face-to-face friendship kind of level. This time is designed for us to connect with God and to interact with Him and to share our hearts with Him and to have Him work in us. So we're going to commune with Him.